streaking the window, the scent of perfume and cigarette smoke on the air. This was not the sort of scene in which one should find evidence of Satan. By now there could be no doubt. It was ready for battle. Tireless battle. Which meant the Smurls would have to be ready to fight back if they were to survive. Lorraine's eyes opened. Diane said, "I hate to give them the news. If we don't, then they won't have a chance at driving him out."
"I know,"
Diane said softly.
"It's just,
we'll have to help them, Diane. We'll have to help them every way we can." The women said another prayer, and then went downstairs to give the Smurls some very bad news. Satan and his allies. When they were gathered at the kitchen table, Janet having served fresh coffee and some sandwiches, Lorraine said, "There are four spirits in your home." Janet and Jack glanced at each other uneasily. "One of them is an elderly woman, probably senile, but not violent. She's just confused. There's another woman, much younger, and she's an insane, violent spirit who might want to harm you, but I think she can be dealt with through prayer. The third spirit in the house is a man, and at this point all we know about him is that he has a mustache and possesses the ability to carry out great harm. Then there is the fourth spirit." Here she paused. "I want you to remain calm when I tell you about him." Lorraine could see Janet and Jack tense.
"You're going to tell us it's a demon, aren't you?"
Janet asked. From her reading, she'd learned that sometimes spirit habitations could be relatively harmless and often could be dispelled by constant prayer and house blessing. Then there were demons. Lorraine said, "The demon is here to create chaos and destroy the family." She watched how Jack's open hand became a fist. "The demon will use the other three spirits to his advantage," Lorraine went on. "It will appear in many guises, and the way he will try to destroy you will assume many forms." Jack's fist came down on the table. In his face you could see the weariness that frustration and useless rage had wrought.
"But why would it pick on us?"
Now it was Ed's turn to speak. A big man with graying hair and piercing green eyes, he spread wide hands over the table and said, "It's like I said before, Jack. I suspect that the demon has been in the house, dormant, for decades. That I can't be sure of. But one thing I know is that your girls reaching puberty gave the demon energy. That's the classical pattern. Puberty often brings on infestations. The demon is drawing on their emotional turbulence, and now it's tapping into yours. You're like a battery it draws on for power. It's a real psychic explosion. It wants to keep you and your family confused and afraid. That's why it often appears to only one of you at a time. Nothing causes confusion the way that does. Karen says she sees something, but nobody else sees it. So in the back of your mind, you wonder if Karen really saw anything. This is one way the demon has of keeping your family in constant turmoil and trying to break you apart." Jack sighed, lit a cigarette.
"I can't sleep anymore. I'm so tired. I could barely light this up."
He waved the cigarette in Ed's direction. "Remember what I said about you being a battery the demon draws power from? That's what's going on here. You're always tired. And that's one reason you're always cold." Ed has a sip of coffee. "There's an entity that's trying to drain the life force from you." Janet. "As we listened to the Warrens and Diane talk, I remember feeling a strange combination of relief and dread. The relief stemmed from the fact that it was reassuring somehow that somebody knew all these things about demonic infestation. We felt they could genuinely help us in our battle. The dread came from knowing that Ed, Lorraine, and Diane were confirming our worst suspicions. Our house had been taken over by a demon." An experiment. That day, Ed and Lorraine spent an hour with John and Mary Smurl, during which John admitted that he'd first been skeptical about the haunting of the duplex, but now he knew better.
"My God, Ed," Mary Smurl said, "you have to see what's going on here to believe it. I hope to God you believe us."
Ed smiled and touched Mary's hand. "We've seen the supernatural at work, Mary, and we're here to help." Mary, still in failing health, smiled for the first time in weeks. Around 6:30, Janet served a dinner of ham, potato salad, baked beans, and coffee. During dinner, Ed said,
"I'm going to have to ask you to trust me."
Jack said, "I think I can speak for both of us when I say that we do trust you." Janet nodded.
"Then after we finish eating, why don't we go up to your bedroom?"
Janet laughed.
"Do we get a hint, or are you going to keep us in suspense?"
Lorraine said, "It's a very special process. We're going to see if we can get the demon to expose itself in some way. Diane operates a camera with infrared film, and I run a tape recorder. Sometimes we can record evidence of them."
Ed glanced around the table at everybody.
"Whenever you're ready." In the bedroom, Jack, Janet, and Lorraine sat on the bed. Ed stood in a corner near the window. Diane positioned herself in front of the dresser. She operated a 35mm camera on a tripod. The room was long with the shadows of a winter night and the skeletal fingers of trees silhouetted by a streetlight outside. Bed springs squeaked. Jack's breathing from his heavy smoking came hard. Janet took her husband's hand, whispered,
"I'm scared, hon."
Jack offered her a small smile and whispered back,
"So am I."
"Now we need to pray,"
Ed said from the darkness in the corner. Janet had always liked the resonant way prayer sounded in churches when many people prayed together. The room had that same feeling now as they all said three Our Fathers and three Hail Marys. When the prayers were finished, Ed reached over and put a tape in the recorder. The beautiful strains of Ave Maria, sung by a nun, filled the room. The voice magnificent, the lyrics touching. The room seemed to be transformed for those long minutes. It felt friendly and peaceful again, the way it had when the Smurls had first moved here. When the song had ended, Jack switched off the recorder and turned on the lights. To Lorraine, he said, "Anything?"
"Maybe."
"Can you describe it?"
She closed her eyes, touched long fingers to her forehead.
"A very bright light in front of the closet, and a dimmer one by the bedroom door."
Ed nodded.
"We're going to do it again, everybody. Ready?"
Jack and Janet nodded. Once more, the lights went out, and Ave Maria was played. They had just begun to pray when they heard a tearing sound, as if someone was being ripped from the wall.
"The mirror,"
Janet said. In the gloom, they could see one of two large mirrors attached to the dresser with screws starting to move back and forth, as if it were going to rip free of its mountings.
"What is it?"
Janet said.
"The demon,"
Ed replied calmly.
"Look at the TV," Jack said.
The Smurls kept a black and white portable television set on their dresser. Lately, the plug had given them some trouble, so they now kept it unplugged, except when in use, fearing fire. But now an eerie white glow, the white-silver color of apparitions, filled the screen and bathed Jack's and Janet's bodies in its strange color.
"I'd move away from there," Lorraine said.
Then, hearing a crashing sound, she saw Diane jumping away from the dresser by which she'd been standing. There was a rustling in the drawers now. Before long, they started to shake furiously. Ed said,
"I have to move quickly now."
The glow from the TV continued, as did the rustling inside the drawers. The mirror was shaking wildly, looking as if it were about to be torn completely free of the bureau. Ed took a container of holy water, made a large sign of the cross in the air, and began sprinkling the room as he prayed.
"In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to be gone!"
Janet and Jack held hands and stood very close together as Ed walked around with the holy water. He continued to pray. Gradually, the glow from the TV diminished, and then was gone. Gradually, the bureau drawers ceased their violent rattling. Gradually, the mirror settled quietly back in place and remained stationary.
The Lord be praised, Ed said finally. Let us offer our thanks.
Standing there in the shadows, they all said prayers of thanks. Jack recalled later, I had a sense at that moment that things were pretty much over. That Ed and Lorraine and Diane had pretty much figured out how to deal with the spirits that had invaded our house. But as Ed told us before they left, this was really just the beginning in a lot of ways. And unfortunately, his prediction turned out to be true.
Making plans. Once again, the Warrens, Diane, and the Smurls gathered around the kitchen table. In our investigations, Ed explained, we've discovered that there are hot spots in houses that are haunted, places where we pick up the strongest feeling of the spirits. Here, this means your bedroom. It's really a haven for them. And to pass over into John and Mary's duplex, they use the closet in your bedroom.
Jack, as I sat in our living room, the windows dark with night and frost collecting in their corners, I thought of how much my life had changed in the past year, and now it was about to change even more because we knew for sure what we were facing. A part of what I felt, of course, was fear, that if anybody found out about what was really going on here, they'd think my family was either making these things up or that we were crazy.
How can we fight them? Janet asked.
You can start with this, Ed said, and handed her a piece of paper. A prayer had been typed on it.
In the name of Jesus Christ, in the blood of Christ, I command you to leave and to return from where you came. Ed said, use this when you feel in danger. If you can, use holy water and make a large sign of the cross, too.
And tomorrow, Lorraine said, there are some things you should get. Diane nodded.
We'd advise that you go to a church diocesan shop and buy religious candles and incense and get plenty of holy water.
Ed finished his coffee.
One more thing. I'd really urge you to call a priest tomorrow and see if he would consider doing an exorcism here.
Will they do that?
Janet asked.
If you convince them that this is really happening, Ed said.
I'll call the parish first thing in the morning, Janet said.
Jack sighed, stubbed out his cigarette.
He looked evenly at Ed Warren and said, I'm going to ask you a simple question.
Sure.
Is all this going to help?
I'm going to give you a simple answer, Ed said. I don't know. The demon we're dealing with here is very strong. Very strong. Sometimes we are able to drive these things out through fairly easy tactics.
He shook his head.
Other times...
He did not have to finish the sentence.
Lorraine said, what we've done here tonight may just be the preliminary work. We'll call you in the morning and see how things are going. We may have to send over a special team to keep helping you.
You do that?
Janet said.
Lorraine smiled. That's why we're here, Janet. To help.
But we couldn't afford...
Lorraine raised her hand. We don't charge for our services. We've had 3 books written about us, we've been consultants to Dino De Laurentiis, and we're constantly on the lecture circuit. Fortunately, that enables us to provide our services free of charge. She patted Janet's hand, then glanced at the watch on her slender wrist.
It's time we go. We've got a long drive ahead of us.
At the door, Janet said...
We really can't thank you enough.
Just remember about going to the church store tomorrow, and keep that prayer with you at all times, Ed said.
Then he looked at the 4 Smurl children, who had been sitting in the front room watching television as the grown-ups discussed the infestation. He smiled and waved to them.
And remember, girls, make sure your parents stay just as brave as you are.
The girls laughed. The Warrens headed out to their van in the snowy, bitter cold night.
A Night of Trial.
After the Warrens and Diane left, Janet and Jack sat in the living room with their 4 girls and explained to them the events of the day.
What are we going to do?
Kim, the 2nd eldest, asked after her mother finished talking.
Janet explained how tomorrow they were going to go to the church store and buy various things, and we're going to have to pray harder than we ever have. Jack put out his hands. Shannon, one of the twins, took one of his hands. Dawn, the other. Then Janet and Kim and Karen joined their hands, too. For the next 20 minutes, the Smurl family prayed with an intensity it had never summoned before. Evidence of an entity that could well destroy their entire family had been presented on this day. Only God's help could save them. As the girls were getting ready for bed, brushing their teeth, slipping into heavy cotton pajamas, Janet and Jack went into the kitchen.
I don't want the girls to know this, Janet said, taking her husband's hand, but I'm very scared.
So am I.
What are we going to do?
The only thing we can. What the Warrens told us to do. She sighed.
Maybe it would be better if we all slept downstairs tonight.
Jack thought a moment.
I don't think so, honey.
But why not?
He squeezed her hand and gave her a soft, tender kiss.
We can beat this thing. And that's what we've got to remember. We can beat this thing.
He said this with the sort of angry determination he would more and more come to draw on in the ensuing months. That night, the family took their usual places in the 3 bedrooms.
Do you know the thing we saw one day?
Karen whispered. The twins had been tucked into their beds, prayers said, lights off, but they were too stirred up from the day's events to sleep.
The gray thing?
Shannon said.
Yes. Do you think it's in our room right now? Do you? Are you just trying to scare me? No. I don't think it's in here,
Shannon said.
Are you just saying that? No.
They said nothing for a time. There were just the sounds of their own breathing and the winter wind rattling windows throughout the house. For young children, shadows can be as deep and dark as the ocean. And that was how it seemed to Karen and Shannon as they lay in their beds, listening. Then the knock came.
Did you hear that?
Karen whispered.
Yes.
From the beginning of the infestation, the Smurls had been bothered by knockings within the walls. Sometimes these were little more than single raps. Other times, they were sharp, staccato bursts, as if a hammer were being pounded very rapidly against the wall. There was a third variety, a deep, imploding sound that seemed to send tremors from the foundation of the house up through the floors and all the way to the chimney. The Smurls sensed that an earthquake might sound and feel like this. It was this thunderous sound that caused the girls to sit up now.
Something's weird,
Karen said.
I know,
Shannon said softly.
You afraid?
Karen sighed.
You think everything's going to be all right?
Shannon didn't have any answer for that one. In the bedroom of Jack and Janet.
What was that?
The stinging slap had sounded like leather against flesh.
It just hit me,
Janet said. Then there was another slapping sound, and Janet cried out. Jack grabbed her. There in the darkness of their bedroom, he felt forces swirling around them, like a vortex that would take them down, down into a deep and unimaginable hell. He clung to his wife, as if she were drowning. Then he felt a tickling sensation on the bottoms of his feet. Not the sort of tickling that causes laughter, but the sort that can induce weakness and even madness if prolonged enough. Jack jumped around on the bed as if he were losing his mind.
Jack! Jack!
Janet cried, as invisible hands continued to slap at her, and now to produce an ugly animal frenzy in her husband. Then the knocking began. The deep, cavernous knocking that reverberated throughout the house. Boom. Boom. Boom.
They want to prove to us they're the superior ones,
Janet said. And, as if to confirm her words, at that instant, their portable television set bloomed again with the eerie, pale glow it had emitted when the Warrens had been in here. The glow grew so intense this time that Jack and Janet had to look away in pain. The set was still disconnected.
Jack flung himself off the bed and stood, bare-chested, his hands, big fists.
"Why don't you show yourself to us so we can have a fair fight?"
he shouted at the shifting shadows. Janet came to his side, clung to him. It took her many minutes to calm her husband down. The knocking in the walls continued. It was like being on military patrol. The good German shepherd patrolled the hall in front of the girls' rooms, keeping alert in case he needed to warn the girls of anything. By now, Simon was well aware, in his way, of demons and what they could do to animals of all description, human and otherwise. Simon was joined throughout the night by Jack Smurl. Carrying a flashlight long and heavy enough to double as a formidable weapon, Jack woke many times during the long night to go in and check on his girls. He knew they'd heard the knocking in the walls, and he'd gone in to comfort them when the sounds became especially bad. Finally, around 3 a.m., the pounding ceased. But Jack, frightened for the sake of his girls, took no chances. He still woke. He still patrolled. In the morning, he was, of course, exhausted. As he was eating breakfast, the phone rang and Janet answered it.
"Hello," she said.
"Hi, this is Ed Warren. We're just checking on how things went last night." Janet sighed, eyed Jack nervously.
"Why don't I let you talk to Jack, Ed?"
"Sure, put him on." Jack came to the phone and explained what had happened during the night.
"I was afraid something like this might happen," Ed said, thoughtfully on the other end.
"They're not going to give up. At least not without a real battle.
We're going to call the priest today.
And be sure to get those religious articles."
"Absolutely. And keep angry.
Don't give in to them. We've already talked about recognizing them in various ways, giving them dominance over you and letting them use your energy. Well, anger is one way of making sure that you don't give up."
Jack said in a low voice so the girls eating their cream of wheat couldn't hear, "My family looks like a bunch of zombies this morning. This place was like living in a bunker last night. Like there's a war going on."
Ed Warren said softly,
"Jack, I've got to be honest with you."
"Honest about what?"
Ed paused.
"Jack, there is a war going on."
An indifferent cleric. Janet.
We'd always counted on help from the church, but we found out, bitterly, I have to say, that this wasn't going to be the case. One of the days Ed and Lorraine were here, Lorraine called our local parish and explained to one of the priests, a Father O'Reilly, what was going on in our house, and said that we needed help. He was very curt with her, saying he was busy with a wedding rehearsal, and that she should call another time. After he'd hung up, Lorraine said they were used to this kind of treatment from priests. Ed then suggested that we get certain religious objects and have them blessed for the safety of our family. But when I went to get them blessed, the same priest treated me basically the way he'd treated Lorraine. Even though I told him about everything that had been happening to us, he showed no real interest or sympathy. He blessed the objects I'd brought, but he didn't use holy water, and as soon as he was done, he rushed away. He didn't ask me any questions at all.
This was to be only the beginning of Janet's problems with the church she'd grown up trusting and believing in. The demon stirs. In the days following Father O'Reilly's refusal to visit the Smurl home, and the depressing impact this refusal had on the family, the Smurls discovered just how accurate Ed Warren had been about their being involved in a war. A discovery. After school one day, Dawn came home to find her makeup missing from her bureau. This was typical of events around the house lately, the spirits vanishing many of the family's belongings. On this particular afternoon, however, Dawn did not react in the way an average 16-year-old would when presented with evidence of demons. Instead, she got angry. She even joked about it.
"I know why you took my makeup,"
she shouted to the spirits she felt in the room.
"It's because you're ugly and your mommy dresses you funny."
Janet, passing by her daughter's bedroom, heard this and began laughing. She stopped laughing when violent banging began inside the walls. Now Janet became apprehensive.
Had Dawn made the demon so angry that it would hurt her? Janet had promised herself that the next time the wall poundings began, she would run and get a tape recorder, which she did now. Kneeling by the knocking, Janet started the tape recorder and then said,
"I want to communicate with you."
"Mother,"
Dawn whispered. Addressing the demon again, Janet said,
"I want you to knock once for yes and twice for no. Do you understand?"
Dawn went over and sat on the bed, both afraid and fascinated.
"Do you understand?"
Janet repeated to the demon. Nothing. Janet checked the tape recorder and then proceeded to have a most curious conversation.
"Are you here to harm us?"
Nothing.
"It's not going to talk to us,"
Dawn said.
"Are you here to harm us?"
Janet repeated. This time, there came a knock. A single knock. The answer was yes. The demon was here to harm them. Janet gasped.
"Are you here to harm me?"
Janet asked, wanting to make sure that the first knock had indeed been in response to her question. Another single knock. Yes. Janet knew that her next question might cause the demon to go berserk. She would introduce into the conversation the name of the being that had driven Satan from heaven, God himself. Janet said,
"Do you believe in Jesus Christ?"
The response was immediate and furious. The banging became so loud and intense that Janet was pushed back from the wall, kicking over the tape recorder as she was flung over it. Dawn buried her face in the pillow, trying to shield her ears from the overwhelming rapping.
"Stop! Stop!"
Janet called out to the demon. 3 or 4 minutes later, the banging stopped. Janet's first move was to write the recorder, rewind the tape, and play it back to see if the entire episode had been recorded. Thankfully, it had been. She went over and sat on the bed next to Dawn, sliding her arm around her.
"Why didn't you run out of the room, honey? I know you were scared."
Dawn grinned.
"I wanted to be here in case I needed to protect you."
Janet had never been prouder of her daughter than at that moment. Bathing trouble. Finished with her housework for the day, Janet Smurl was taking a bath. She'd just gotten settled in the tub, lathering herself with Dove, when suddenly she felt eyes on her. She had never felt quite so naked or vulnerable. She continued with her bath, soaping her face gently and rinsing off the soap right away. Then the whistling began. It was the kind of lascivious whistling women have to endure around groups of drunken men filled with both innuendo and threat. Janet began screaming. Jack, reading the paper downstairs, ran up the stairs 2 at a time. He flung back the bathroom door and came in to find Janet crouched in the corner of the tub, trembling.
"It's in here,"
she said. Then she told him about the whistling.
"Please stay here with me, Jack. Please."
"Don't worry," Jack said. Across from the bathroom door was a crucifix he'd used to keep the hallway safe. He pushed the door wide open now so that Janet could see the cross. He sat in there with her until she finished her bath. As she toweled off, Janet said dejectedly,
"Now it's getting so bad we need a bodyguard to take a bath."
Strange women. Exhausted from a long day at work and from the tension that filled the house, Jack fell asleep one Friday night earlier than usual. Around 2 a.m., he was awakened by the sounds of people talking. He thought it might be the twins, but at 2 a.m.? Then he looked up and saw 2 women in the room. One appeared to be in her early 40s, the other around 20. They wore old-fashioned bonnets and long dresses that cast an eerie sheen similar to that of the glowing TV set. Oddly, their hair had no exact color. Then they were gone. Instantly. In the morning, Jack told Janet about the peculiar apparition. They both agreed that it could well have been a dream brought on by the stress the family was under. That night, however, the same 2 women reappeared. Jack watched them as they stood in the shadowy corner of the bedroom. He tried to wake Janet but couldn't. By now he knew that she was experiencing the psychic sleep that allowed the demon to appear to one person without having the other person awaken to corroborate the appearance.
This night the women began whispering to each other. Then the younger one turned to Jack and smiled. Her lips curled sarcastically. He tried to cry out but found he had no voice. He tried to move off the bed but found he was paralyzed. He tried to wake Janet again but to no avail. He lay and watched them whisper and sneer at him. Then they eased back into the closet from where they'd come and disappeared. Even 3 full days and nights later, Jack still shuddered involuntarily whenever he thought of the 2 women and their strangely threatening presence. The team arrives. Ed and Lorraine Warren began, by early February, to call the Smurls virtually every day. The assault by the demon grew worse daily. Finally, the Warrens dispatched to the Smurls' home a team of psychic researchers who were to analyze the family's situation in the smallest detail. On an overcast February morning, a dark sedan pulled up in front of the Smurls' duplex, carrying Jason Kearns and Ricky Monroe. Jason was a legal secretary from Bridgeport, Connecticut, who had assisted the Warrens in many dealings with the supernatural. Ricky is from Huntington and presently studies demonology with the Warrens. Jason, as Ed had warned me, I could sense a demonic presence, even from across the street. I looked around at the pleasant houses lining both sides of the street, at the everyday sights of children in bulky snowsuits playing behind mounds of snow, and at dogs and cats hurrying down the street through the cold, and I was amazed, as I always am, that in the most common of settings, such as this one, Satan finds a way to enter people's lives. After meeting Janet, Jack, and the children, Jason and Ricky began setting up tape recorders in the upstairs hallway, examining the entrance points the spirits used to go back and forth between the duplexes, and interviewing each member of the Smurl family. "I want to tell you something right up front," Jason said when they'd all gathered in the living room. "I'm going to start with the assumption that you're not telling us the truth." "What?" Janet said, somewhat shocked and insulted. "You're going to need to prove to me that your house has been infested."
"But why?"
"Because many people do things like this to get attention for themselves or just to play a kind of practical joke."
"But after all we've been through," Janet said.
Jason held up his hand. "I've been told you've been through all these things, but I don't know that for a fact." "Now wait a minute," Jack spoke up. Jason said, "Put yourself in my place, Jack. I'm a trained psychic investigator. If I just automatically accepted everybody's word for things, would I really be doing my job?"
"The Warrens said you'd ask us some tough questions," Janet said, laughing and easing the tension in the room. "They sure weren't kidding."
Over the next few hours, the Smurls relived the entire haunting. Though, as Janet admitted,
"We're not sure when it started exactly. I guess we'd have to date it, to be official, about the time that both Mary and I saw the black form."
The Smurls then went on to detail all the major rappings, odors, whispers, and apparitions that had been inflicted on them, concluding with the appearance of the strange women in Janet's and Jack's bedroom.
"You didn't find anything in the morning?" Jason asked Jack.
"Find anything?"
"Any evidence."
"Like what?"
"Oh, a button? A strand of their oddly colored hair, maybe?"
"No.
But you're sure you didn't dream them?"
"Now, wait a minute." Janet gently patted Jack's hand. He calmed down.
"I know I didn't dream them. They were too real. Everything about it was real."
Jason nodded, made notes in the thick book lying open on his lap. Ricky.
"He was questioning them about the 2 women when I heard the first knocking. It was incredible and really frightening. I'd been studying demonology with the Warrens for some time, but I'd never actually had this type of experience before. It was like the air in the room froze. Jason ran upstairs to make sure the recorders were working properly so we'd be sure to get the rappings on the tape."
For the next hour, hard rapping ranged from room to room, as the spirits seemed to work themselves up into a kind of frenzy.
"Jason, by then, of course, I didn't have any doubt what we were dealing with. It was demonic infestation. We spent the entire night listening to, recording, and cataloging a variety of experiences associated with the supernatural. Everything from tape recordings on which we can hear the rappings, to odors that appeared in certain places in the house. We made entries in our logs every 5 minutes. By morning, we were all exhausted. Janet made us a great breakfast of eggs and sausage and toast, and then we went back to Connecticut to talk with the Warrens. We had several tapes that we felt proved conclusively that a demon was in the house.
Another member of the team, Brad Peterson, joined Ricky on the next trip. Brad interviewed Shelley Adams and her parents across the street and then picked up with the Smurls where Jason had left off, asking them if they believed in ghosts, if they had any unusual religious affiliations, or if they had done anything that might have invited the demon in. Midway through Brad's visit, the pounding began again.
Brad, you try to describe it to people and they can't imagine it. You're standing looking at a plain wall and all of a sudden these sounds erupt from inside, as if somebody is running up and down the wall, somebody invisible. It gives you chills. It really does. But the rapping wasn't the only thing that bothered me that afternoon. It was the look of the family. I work as a paramedic. I see people under very stressful circumstances. By the way the Smurls behaved, I could see that they were being pushed to the brink. I could see that we, meaning the entire Warren team, were going to have to get involved.
Next day, following a long meeting in the morning, Ed and Lorraine Warren decided on two things: to pay the Smurls a second visit and to get various other experts involved. The people they selected included a doctor who was a medical examiner in Connecticut, Jeff Newton, a 19-year veteran of the Hartford, Connecticut Police Department, Brady Cotter, a statistician for a large marketing company, and Chris McKenna, the Warren's grandson, who has a BA in psychology. At different times over the ensuing months, these people played key roles in trying to drive the spirits from the duplex on West Chase Street. At the moment, however, the Warren's presence was required, and so on a sunny March day they again made the 4-hour drive. By now they knew much more about the nature of the infestation. Unfortunately, most of their news for the Smurls would be bad news. The Apprentice Demonologist. The odd thing is, as a boy he was never interested in comic books or movies or paperbacks about the occult. A straight-A student who preferred history to English and math to music, he was one of those sensible young men who came dangerously close to being a nerd. Today he laughs. I had all the usual teenage failings, the zits, the wrinkled clothes, the anxiety around pretty girls, the indecision about my future, but if nothing else, I was realistic. My parents always praised me for that. I had a part-time job at a small grocery store when I was 11, and ever since then, I've worked steadily. I always took care of the things they bought me. The Schwinn I got for my 10th birthday looks almost as good today as it did when my parents gave it to me for Christmas 15 years ago. And I was always in on time and always told them what I was going to do. About the only big night I ever had in high school was once when a friend of mine and I took 4 cans of Budweiser from his dad's refrigerator and sat down in the garage and drank them. This was at the same time socially when most kids our age were smoking pot or taking LSD. And this kind of conservatism extended into my college years, too. I decided to be an engineer. Nice, safe, secure, and empirical. I wasn't religious, and whenever anybody mentioned any sort of weird phenomena, and by that I include everything from demons to UFOs, I laughed my engineer laugh and dismissed it. I remember seeing one of my real idols, Arthur C. Clarke, on a TV show once, wondering aloud why UFOs, for example, never landed where large numbers of people could see them. He then went on to disprove, at least to my satisfaction, every single famous incident of a saucer sighting. Donald remained just as skeptical as he'd been during his college years. By the time he graduated, he found that the job market he'd taken for granted had shrunk considerably. He spent hours a day in job interviews, but to no avail.
It was really depressing. I couldn't even get entry-level work. This was right at the top of the recession. I just took what I could find. Usually whatever the local state employment office could find for me on a day work basis. I lived at home, of course, because I couldn't afford to move out and find my own apartment.
One cold Friday night in November, bored and depressed that his birthday was coming up and that there was still no job prospect in sight, Donald went to the Regal, a relic of the era when movie theaters had been built to resemble palaces, and saw the Amityville Horror. Donald: ordinarily, I wouldn't have chosen a movie like that. For entertainment, I liked Clint Eastwood or Charles Bronson. I still hadn't developed any special taste for horror or the occult. I didn't even like science fiction. But that Friday night, I needed to get out of the house. I'd just spent all day unloading crates in a discount warehouse, and Amityville was the only movie that looked even vaguely interesting. I'd read a few things about the incident, and I suppose that was why I was at least a little intrigued by it. The odd thing was, Donald recounted later, he didn't care much for the movie, thinking it was overacted and illogical in several places. But it did trigger something in me. For the first time, I wondered if all my skepticism about occult phenomena wasn't a bit too pat. Maybe I'd closed my eyes to a whole lot of things. On Monday, Donald went to the state employment office only to find that they didn't even have any day work for him. It was another bitterly cold day, and having a 25-minute wait ahead of him for a city bus, Donald walked 2 blocks to a branch library where he went, as usual, to the nonfiction section. Ordinarily, Donald's reading ran to books on astronomy and current debate on scientific issues. The Amityville Horror still fresh in his mind, today Donald picked up a formidable new volume entitled Mysteries by Colin Wilson, which he opened at random. The first paragraph he read was on page 486. But ever since Dr. Rhodes Buchanan began testing the students of the Cincinnati Medical School for psychometric powers in the 1840s, modern researchers have realized that such powers are far commoner than we think. Poltergeist experiences occur every day of the week. Investigators like Hans Bender and William Roll have examined hundreds. Donald spent the next 6 hours in the library, scarcely aware of afternoon becoming dusk, poring over every single word the author had to say on the subject of the paranormal and the occult. Absolutely without planning it, and even to a degree fighting his better instincts, Donald Bennett became, that afternoon, a fledgling demonologist. Lorraine shares some disturbing facts.
"Please don't be afraid of what we're going to explain to you," Lorraine said to the Smurls next afternoon as the family and the Warrens gathered in the living room. She opened her large, leather-bound notebook and began to read. In summary, she told them that the investigation revealed that all the classic signs of infestation were present in the Smurl duplex, with one exception.
"You're a very solid family, and that's what's so unusual. But that's why I feel so much hope that we can deal with this very well. Because you've got the right kind of spiritual reserves to draw on."
She then went on to list the incidents the Smurls had related to the investigating team as further proof of infestation, finally concentrating on the black form.
"This is the demon. It never stands erect. It always hunches over when it walks or stands, and it can appear out of nowhere. It can disappear into a closet or wall, or anywhere it wants to go. It can also bring a very powerful telepathic hypnosis to bear on any human mind." She nodded to Ed. "We knew a woman once who swore to us that she'd seen the room she was in go up in flames, literally explode. But that hadn't really happened, of course. It was just the demon playing tricks with her mind and trying to confuse her. The demon counts on that, on its power to confuse people. That's its greatest weapon."
Lorraine went on to explain that the spirits roam the earth because they have not accepted the death of their physical bodies. "Most spirits don't harm people, but they can be used by demons, as in your house, to become malevolent." Then Janet asked about all the things that had been missing from the house: clothing, books, makeup, jewelry, and the rosary. Ed explained that this kind of activity was common in hauntings, another way that the demon confused people and caused trouble in the family. He said,
"Remember how you told us that Dawn and Shannon got into an argument because Dawn thought that Shannon had taken something of hers? That's a good example of what the demon likes to do."
As they talked, Lorraine glanced out the window and saw a yellow school bus working its way down the street.
I'd like to wrap this up before the kids get home, so I'll be brief.
She pointed to her notebook.
I've looked over the notes the entire team took, and I'd have to say that this demon is even worse than we suspected.
She gave Janet time to put her head down in her hands and shake her head. Obviously, Janet felt both bitter and weary. Lorraine was used to seeing these emotions reflected on the haggard faces of a demon's victims. Lorraine said,
"And this morning I experienced the demon firsthand myself."
Janet's head came up.
"You did?"
"Unfortunately, yes. Right after we got here, I went upstairs and started walking around the girls' rooms. When I was near Dawn's bed, I heard scratching sounds on the window. It sounded like something frantically clawing at the glass. When I looked up, I saw the black form standing outside, looking in. It was really hideous."
Ed, trying to reassure the Smurls, said, "We've found a priest to bless the house."
"A priest? Really?"
Janet smiled, for the first time that day. Ed frowned.
"Since you don't seem to be having much luck with the church, we thought we'd try."
Lorraine said,
"We just hope it will do some good."
The priest came promptly at 6 p.m. He was a calm, courteous man, and Janet liked him, though she noticed how apprehensive he looked, and his furtive glances at Jack and herself made her feel like some kind of freak. Had the priest heard stories about the Smurls? Was the word getting around that the family was crazy? Finished with his rituals, the priest bade them a quiet good night and left.
"He's heard about us, hasn't he?"
Janet asked Ed once the priest had gone. Ed was uncomfortable with her question, knowing what it implied.
"He was probably just nervous."
"People are starting to talk about us, aren't they?"
Janet said. Ed sighed.
"Possibly. Word gets around, and people start to gossip."
"And the priest has heard some of that gossip."
Lorraine sighed.
"She may be right, Ed. Maybe word has gotten all over the area." "A priest," Janet said. "You'd think of all people he'd want to be helpful."
She thought again of how her church, the church she'd been a part of since her baptism, had deserted her. She excused herself and went into the kitchen and wept soft, silent tears. That night they all went out to eat in a local restaurant, the girls using the occasion to get their standard favorites, malts, cheeseburgers, and French fries, and Janet glad to see that even in the midst of all this craziness, her daughters had not lost their appetites. And then they returned to the house where Ed was going to perform the very dangerous rite of religious provocation. At that moment, they didn't have any idea just how dangerous it would prove to be. Ed Warren.
After dinner that evening, I went up to Janet's and Jack's bedroom, prepared to force the demon to expose itself through a ritual known as religious provocation. It works this way. You invoke the name of Jesus Christ and his sacred blood, and then you command the demon to reveal itself and be banished from the home. In the past, we'd often had success with this ritual, and I was very hopeful that it would prove useful that night. But when I entered the bedroom, I felt a chill in the air, as if a presence were literally robbing the air of warmth. And I saw on the bed the shredded spread Janet had found clawed one morning. I walked around the room, then paused over by the closet, which was, I knew, where the spirits resided, from which point they passed between duplexes. And then my senses were overcome. I don't know any better way to describe it. Have you ever had anybody hold a vial of camphor up to your nose? Do you know how it seems to stun you and knock you backward? That's what began to happen to me. Then things got even worse. I started to say a prayer out loud, and invisible fingers seized my throat, choking me. I'd never been strangled before, and the sensation was incredible, especially since I couldn't see my assailant. I could feel my lungs burning for air, and I felt blood filling my face. I was hot and dizzy and unable to breathe. When we'd investigated Amityville, I'd had an experience where I felt as if somebody had put a hot, steamy rag over my face, but this was much worse. I was literally pawing at the air like an animal. I realized there was only one way I could save myself,
and that was to place myself into what is called religious resistance. It's very difficult to do at a time when you're being assaulted, but it was my only hope. As carefully as I could, I envisioned the white light of Jesus Christ around my body. I pictured my body glowing with this protective seal, literally the love of God. Gradually, even though I was knocked back flat on the bed, I began to feel the unseen thumbs that pressed at my throat slowly begin to ease up. At this point, one of my assistants, Jeff Newton, came into the room and saw what was happening to me. He began praying with me, and the pressure on my throat let up even more. Finally, I was able to sit up and breathe normally again. Jeff asked me many questions about what had happened, and we both agreed that the infestation in this house was probably the worst we'd ever seen. And what happened next certainly bore out this suspicion. Despite the fact that the demon had attempted to strangle me, I planned to keep on performing religious provocation in each of the bedrooms, my hope being that in this way the Smurls would have some peace. I stood in the hallway gathering my senses and strength and my courage, still shaken from nearly being choked to death. In one hand I carried a crucifix and, as it turned out, it was a good thing I had it. The adjacent bedroom was shadowy. The beds were made, clothes neatly put away in the closet, books, records, and school items lining shelves. I had just started to pray when I sensed an abrupt chill pass through the room like an invisible cloud. In less time than it took to say three Hail Marys, the room temperature dropped at least 30 degrees. I continued to demand, even though I was starting to get very cold, that the demon be gone. Obviously, it was not responding happily to my demands because I saw a thin, silver gossamer thread start to form in the ornate mirror above the bureau. Stunned, I watched as the thread began to form letters of the alphabet. First Y, and then an O, and then a U. I continued to shake from the freezing cold, but I had no choice but to watch, fascinated, as the vile message began to show itself fully. Though I'd investigated hauntings for more than 40 years now, I'd never seen anything at all like this. Then the message was complete. It read, "You filthy bastard. Get out of this house." A horrible stench filled my nostrils. The temperature fell even more, and I felt a dangerous paralysis set in. Demons often like to immobilize people. It makes it much easier for them to work their tricks. Then I remembered the crucifix in my hand. I raised it to the mirror and commanded the demon to leave. At first its message remained clear and in place, but the longer I cried out Christ's name, the less vivid the gossamer writing was. Finally, the thread-like material began to melt, almost like snow exposed to brilliant sunlight. The stink left the room. I felt my body temperature began to warm. I wish I could say that I felt as if I'd just won a victory, but I didn't. Then, and not without guilt, I let my eyes fall to the crucifix in my hand. I thought of Christ and his suffering. What was my small ordeal compared to his? A smile crossed my face as I stared at the place where the mirror message had appeared. I should take heart from what the Lord Jesus had just helped me do. I shouldn't feel fear. Armed with my new determination and after checking the last bedroom, I went downstairs to see what the others were doing. The apprentice demonologist. At the same time that Janet and Jack Smurl were just beginning to experience the first terrifying examples of demonic infestation, Donald Bennett was starting to look around for serious contacts in the world of the paranormal. While his days were still spent looking for some way in which to put his engineering degree to use, he visited the library as often as he could, culling through books and newspapers that reached as far back as the last century. Being both intelligent and healthily skeptical, Donald soon learned that there was a wide cavern separating the genuine students of the occult and those who were simply seeking thrills or publicity. In his bedroom, the walls covered with posters of the rock group Heart, Leave It to Cleavage, someone had once remarked by way of explaining the group's success. Donald spent hours nibbling on Fritos and drinking Diet Pepsi and poring over the books he'd brought home from the library. Occasionally, when bitter winter wind whipped the windows and when the hour was past midnight, he heard creaking in the house he'd never heard before. A sense of something sinister filled him at these moments, and he would set his book down, his heart pounding, realizing that for all his deeply entrenched skepticism, he was very much afraid. One time when fear suddenly overcame him, he broke its spell by wondering how his parents would feel if their 23-year-old son came into their room and asked if he could sleep with them. The image was so hilarious that he set his book aside and took a break, going downstairs to have a sandwich, and then went into the living room to watch one of the few science fiction movies he'd ever liked. It Came from Outer Space, an especially convincing account of an alien invasion written by Ray Bradbury and directed by the great Jack Arnold. This was his life, then. Useless job interview after useless job interview. He was sending out resumes in ever-widening patterns all the way west to Chicago by now, and hours in the library or in his room reading books on the paranormal and the occult. In a magazine, he found the name of a group of local paranormalists who met 3 times a month. He spent the week before the meeting as excited as he'd been about his